Okay, so the topic has a lot to do with Parshat Vayera and so many different parts of the Sedra, but I want to start with a Rashi that appears in Perek Chav Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, which is just at the beginning of the story of Yishmael being kicked out of the home of Avraham Avinu. And obviously it comes from the instructions of Sarah, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu, even though it may be difficult to send Yishmael away, you should listen to her. And Chazal actually darshan from there that on some level, Sarah had a stronger, more powerful koch of nevuah to be able to arrive at that conclusion. And that's why Hashem has to tell Avram, Shema b'kol, listen to what she says. And the reaction of Avram Avinu, the Pasuk says, is Vayera hadavar ma'od b'nei Avram al odos b'no. Something bothered him very much. Something bothered him very much al odos b'no regarding his son. So what was it? What was it about this episode that was so troublesome for Avram Avinu? So Rashi brings to pshat him. Rashi, initially, al odos b'no, right on the spot, has a medrash rabbah, al sheshama sheyotzot tarvis ro. What was so bothersome for him was that he realized, he heard, right, what emerged from this conversation was that Yishmael had went off the derech. He totally betrayed the upbringing that Avraham Avinu had given him. Al sheshama sheyotzot tarvis ro. The fact that he has to kick him out of his house because he's off the derech, that was troubling for Avraham Avinu. Then Rashi adds, "Upshuto al sheomeres lo l'shacha." The pashut pshat is, he was troubled by the fact that Sarah told him to send his son away. So what's fascinating over here is that both pshat make sense. It makes sense that Avraham Avinu is is bothered by the fact that he has to send him away, and it makes sense that he's bothered by the the fact that he is unfortunately not the child that he was hoping he would grow up to be, to say the least. At least not at this point of his life. Rashi says elsewhere that he came back and did tshuva. Rashi says that at the end of the parsha. But at the end of the day, these two pshatim are diametrically opposed. They're mamish inconsistent with each other. What were Avraham Avinu's feelings? If he was upset that Yishmael was off the derech, then okay, he would have been very understanding of the fact that he has to send them away so he doesn't have a bad hashpa on Yitzhak. But in the same breath, Rashi in the same breath is able to say that he was also troubled by the fact that he has to send them away, and that's push pshat on the pasuk. Which one is it? Which one is it? It's one thing to have more than one pshat, multiple layers of pshat, but to have contradictory layers of pshat in the same Rashi, how do we put that together? What does Rashi want us to take away from that dichotomy, so to speak? So I want to depart from the parsha for the moment, take us very far away from Parsha Vayera, and come back eventually, Mr. Hashem, full circle in a little while. So when it comes to Hallel on the seventh day of Pesach, the eighth day in Chutz La'aretz, so we know what's unique about the end of Pesach, as opposed to, let's say, the end of Sukkot, is that after the initial days of Yontif, on Pesach we do not recite a full Hallel. We only say a Chatzi Hallel. And that's different than Sukkot, where we say a Hallel Shalom the entire Yontif. But what is the reason? Why is it that there's a difference between Pesach and Sukkot? So the Gemara gives a very simple reason. Gemara says that in certain respects, the days of Sukkot are each considered individualized Yom Tov. They may all be recognized as one long holiday that we call Sukkot, but each one has a unique character to it. And the way that that's expressed, the Gemara says, it's an erichin that, as you can tell in your machzor and the Chumash and Parshas Pinchas and the Maftir, every single day of Sukkot is a different Maftir because there's a different number of karbonos brought. And you know they would diminish over the course of Yontif, the Pari HaChag, like we have, right? That was the Sfar Beishamai to start with 8 candles and go down to 1 candle over the course of Hanukkah. But the Pari HaChag vary, Kenege the Umos Olam, and as a result, because the different number of karbonos, each day of Sukkot has its own unique character to it. It's like a separate Yontif on some level. And one nafkamina of that is that we recite a Hallel Shalom because it's like a new day, a new holiday. Calls for a new Hallel. Unlike Pesach, Pesach begins and extends for 7 days, but it's all more one unified entity. And therefore, there isn't a machayev for a brand new Hallel every single day. And so therefore, we just have a minhag of Chatzi Hallel, not a full Hallel every single day. And one way to indicate that also, to recognize that it's the same Karbonos, it's the same Maftir throughout the Yontif, is what you find in that paragraph from Parshas Pinchas that everybody knows by heart, Ka'ela, right? The everyone sings along with the Baal Kore because they're familiar with the mafsik, because it's the same one from the day before, and the day before, and the day before, every single day of Pesach. So that's the reason why Pesach has Chatzi Hal, Sukkot has Hal Shalom, because Sukkot is one day by day, a brand new Yontif. Pesach is one long holiday, and therefore no Hal Shalom is called for after the first day. That's the reason that's given in the Gemara. However, there's a Medrash that's quoted by the Shmuel Aleket, is brought down in the Taz and the Mishnah Berurah and the other Achronim, that totally different reason. Totally different reason why we only say Hef Halal at the end of Pesach. Anyone know what it is? What happened on the last day of Pesach? Last day of Pesach was the day that the Jews got to Yamsuf. Videos on both sides, they got to Yamsuf and Kriyas Yamsuf. Klal Yisrael got through and all the Egyptians died. So it says in the Medrash, that's quoted by the Zachronim, that the Malach HaShareis wanted to call out in Shira at the drowning of the Mitzrayim because the Jews were saved. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded by saying, my creatures, my handiwork, the human beings that I made, they're all dying and you're going to sing Shira. That's inappropriate. Pasuk says in Mishlei, don't be happy even when your enemy, at your enemy's demise. So the reason that's given in the Medrash is that they couldn't sing Shira on the day that all of the Egyptians died, on the seventh day of Pesach, and therefore we only say Chatzi Hal. Okay, so question is, how could it be that the Malachim are told not to say Shira, but what happens? If there's any time in all of history that's famous for the Jewish people calling out in song, it was right then, Oz Yashir. We said a Shira, and we say that Shira every single day. And it says in the post, which brought down the Mishnah Berurah, that when a person recites Oz Yashir Mizuk Zimra, they should have in mind as if they're standing by the Yamsuf witnessing it with the same Simcha. So how could it be that the Malachim were shut down? They're told not to sing, and we're told we should sing. Which one is it? You should rejoice when your enemy dies, or you shouldn't rejoice? So Halacha Maisa, it's interesting, just in our own pretty contemporary times. I remember the day after Osama bin Laden was killed. Was it 2012, 2011? Right? So everyone came to Yeshiva the next morning, wondering what to do. Osama bin Laden was the mastermind behind the 9/11 attack. So in my day, everyone was still feeling, you know, it was 10 years later, but we still felt the trauma of that experience of the 9/11 attack. So when the mastermind behind it was finally captured and finally killed, so it was a mamash day simcha. So do you say halal? So all the rabbanim were giving shurim about that, trying to balance this. Ben folay v'chal al tismach. But there's another pasuk in Mishlei that says bavod rusharim rina, that when rusharim are killed, when they're lost, then you have to celebrate. So if shafter paskin, you say halal without a bracha. And that was, you know, reminded everybody that not so long before, a few years before that, Rav Schechter, I think he was in L.A. for Shabbos, actually. And it was Shabbos morning that the news came that Saddam Hussein was captured. And I think he came into shul that morning, Shabbos. They asked him what to do. People saw it on the cover of the newspapers. And he also passed him to say Hallel without a bracha. So it's mamash like we're standing by the Yamsuf. So do you say Shira or don't say Shira? Why was it that the Malachim did say Shira and were told not to? And here you have the Mitzrim, and they're told that, I'm sorry, and here you have Klal Yisrael, and they're told, no, it's, you know, there's no rejection, there's no stop put to the Shira of Klal Yisrael. We still say the Shira nowadays. So which one is it? That's the question. Do you say Shira, you celebrate the downfall of the Rishon or not? So some say, it's brought from Chaim Lezion, for example, that you have to be Mechalik. You have to be mechalik between the people who are on the sidelines and the people who are actually experiencing Yeshua. Klal Yisrael experience Yeshua on the spot. So they have a right and they have the privilege and the mandate that they should say Shira at the downfall of the Rishon. On the other hand, the Malachim, it wasn't okay to them. You know, their lives weren't at stake, they weren't at risk, so therefore it wasn't in their wasn't appropriate for them to be celebrating when they were the ones experiencing the Yeshua. That's the answer that's given by Rav Chaim Lezion. I'm going to give you another answer, which I think is a huge mafteach to Avodas Hashem in general. And this mahalach comes from the Sefer Simchas, Mayim Beis HaShoeva, one of my favorite svarim of all time, Sefer of the Parsha by Rav Shimon Schwab from the Washington Heights Boris community. And he basically says the following. He says, and it really comes from our Parsha, that there's a qualitative difference, a very, very significant divide between the nature of malachim and the nature of human beings, angels on the one side and people on the other. right at the beginning of the parsha, Rashi comments that the reason why so many malachim had to be sent to Avraham Avinu, why three? Why didn't he need three angels? They had certain things they needed to do. They needed to tell them that Sarah was going to have a child, and to destroy Sodom, and to bring Refuah Shlema to Avraham Avinu. But why three malachim? Just send one. We'll cover all the things that have to get done. So Rashi says, because one malach can only do one shalichas. One malach is not sent to do multiple things at a time. Each malach has its own identity. It has a name. Its name is its mission. A malach is an emissary, a messenger, has a job to do on behalf of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that's it. That's the only job that it does. And for additional jobs, other malachim will be sent to complete those tasks. So therefore, on a deeper level, one thing that emerges from that yisod, not just a question of how many people you know on the roster, on Hashem's roster of malachim, but we see something about the nature of, again, the human beings versus angels. Angels have a certain tunnel vision. They are created to be focused on one specific perspective. A human being doesn't have that limitation. He has 613 mitzvahs, not just one at a time. He has many mitzvahs that he has to be on top of and aware of and focusing on at any given moment. A malach has one command. A human being has the capacity, due to that difference, to see things from multiple angles simultaneously. To be able to process what he encounters in a way that's multidimensional. A malach has one job. Do the job, go back home, and get the next job. It can only see one side of the coin and not take into account more than one angle of whatever is in front of him. And therefore, what Hashem was saying to the malachim when he told them not to sing was not that it's not that there's no room, that it's inappropriate to celebrate when a Rasha dies, when an entire Malchus Rasha, when all of the Mitzrim were drowned in the Amsov. No, that is appropriate. There is an inyan to celebrate. But you can't celebrate it, you malachim can't separate it, if at the same time you can't also appreciate that the very same moment there's a tragedy of the loss of life that's occurring with the crashing down of the waves onto the Egyptians. The malachim, as Rashi says, also at the beginning of the parsha, sadu libchem, when Avraham Avinu offers them something to eat and to satisfy their heart, Rashi says, why is it libchem and not levavchem, like we always find in Psukim and in Tefillah? Because libchem, levavchem, there's only one side. Angel only has a Yetzer Tov. A man has Yetzer Tov and Yetzer. He can look at things again. Multidimensional. If you're going to celebrate the downfall of the Malachim in a one-dimensional way, no thank you. That's going to miss the boat. Klal Yisrael can sing at Yam Suf because as human beings, they are charged, they're responsible, and they have the capacity to see more than one thing going on. Multiple tracks, each one with something to take away and something to implement. And this answer, which allowed the Jewish people to sing and appreciate the loss of life at the same time, is not just an answer, okay, this is how people operate, this is how malachim operate. There's something very practical in the way we look at the world around us that emerges from this. It's a machayev. The Milton Elio and elsewhere Rav debate this question every time you have a portrayal in Chazal, in the Psukim and in the Midrashim of mistakes or averos that malachim do, right? Or sometimes we ascribe some sort of human characteristics to malachim, right? And at the same time, we know that they don't have bechira. Like, what is that meant to teach us? So Rav Dessler's approach is that it's all just a mashal. We have in this week's parsha, right? There was a mistake. One of the malachim misspoke, and he said to Lot, we can't destroy the city until you leave. And Rashi says that as a result, that angel was punished because, what do you mean, we can't destroy the city? Hashem's destroying the city. Malach's not supposed to speak that way. And interestingly, there's a medrash that says that they were punished. Like one punishment Rashi brings later in the parsha is that they had to admit later that they weren't in control. But there's a targum, I believe, in the beginning of Parshas Vayetzeh, the angels going up and down, up and down, 130 some odd years later, those angels going up were finally, those angels from Sodom were allowed to return to Shemayim. But all that time they were banished from Shemayim because they misspoke. So what is all this talk of Malachim having these human characteristics? Rav Dessler says it's just there to teach us a lesson. human beings need to take something from the criticism that the angels are given, not to say that they actually have those human characteristics. So what is the practical lesson here? What is the practical lesson? The answer is that we learn that a yid has an achrayus to operate with multiple mindsets. Even contradictory emotions are sometimes expected of a person. Sometimes it seems difficult, seems impossible, but nevertheless, a person has the ability to do it, work on it, and challenge himself, because sometimes scenarios that you will encounter require more than one attitude at a time. Let me give you an illustration. Rav Schwab, when he was a young bacher, was learning the Mir, and his family lived in Germany. Germany to the Mir, it's one country to another, Mir's in Poland, and when it came time for Ben Zman, he needed to take a lengthy train ride home back to see his family for Yantif. And he didn't have enough money, so he went to the Mashkiach, who ultimately became one of his great influences, Rabbi Rucham Lvovitz, the great Mashkiach Amir, and he said, Rebbe, can I please borrow some money for a train ride to get home, and I'll be able to pay you back when I return from Germany, and I have some more spending money. So Rabbi Rucham, of course, said, I'd be happy to lend you the money, and he gave it to him. After he gave him the money, as you'd imagine, Rav Schwab said to his Rebbe, thank you. And the moment he said thank you, Rabbi Rucham's face lit up in anger and rage and surprise. What's the matter with you? I know you're German, you're so polite, and you use your manners, and you say please, and you say, what, don't you know? Yeshiva Bacher, don't you know it's a tremendous shaila? Many poskim say it's also to say thank you when someone lends you money. It's like ribbis, like you're giving something in exchange, even those sentiments and that those wishes. Some say that's ribbis dvarim, isra rabbanim, to respond that way. So Shrab was a little bit taken aback and surprised, and yes, he was trying to be polite, but okay. Rebbe said it's also to say thank you when someone gives you a loan. It's a shiloh ribbis drabunner, fine. Peseder. Okay, and he walked out humbly and took the money. Went home for Yantif. Fast forward a few months. Next man's mom came along. Same scenario. He said to Rabbi Rucham, okay, Rebbe, I'm going home. And I need to borrow some money, please, to buy a train ticket. So this time Rabbi Schwab was prepared. And he knew the drill. Rabbi Rucham gave him the money. And he didn't say anything. He took it, sort of, you know, bowed his head, goodbye, walked out the room, and just as he was about to close the door, Rucham started yelling, what's the matter with you? Don't you know how to say thank you? Someone does a chesed for you, someone lends you money. You know, why, are you a ben Torah? Are you a mensch? Why, how could you not even say thank you? I lend you money. So Rucham said, really, what do you want from me? A few months ago I was here, and I borrowed the money, and I said thank you, and got angry at me. Now I'm not saying thank you, and you're also getting angry. What am I supposed to do? So he said, you're right. You're correct. You're not supposed to say thank you. That was a lesson from last time. But I don't even see on your face that you're struggling with the fact that you can barely keep that thank you inside. If you were really a mensch, you'd be overflowing and brimming with the need to say thank you and give hakaras hatov, and you'd hardly be able to keep it inside yourself, even though you remain silent. And that was an unbelievable lesson for Schwab, because it taught him that maybe it's also to say thank you, but that doesn't take away the need and the imperative to still feel inside of yourself the mid of Hakaras HaTov. And if I could have said thank you, I would have said thank you. Okay, now that's a tremendous maila and a madrega for a Baal Musar, but it is very practical. It shows that yes, it's possible and sometimes necessary to harbor more than one attitude at a time, and that's what the Torah, that was the lesson we were trying to teach him. Similar to this, Rabbi Victor Miller pointed out, Parshas Vayishlach, we know from the Midrashim that Rashi says over there, Yaakov Avinu hid Dina in a box so that his brother Esau would not see her when they met up, because he was afraid that he would want to take Dina for a wife, and that would be a disaster, that could be very detrimental for Dina's future and the destiny of Klal Yisrael. So he hid her in a box. Nevertheless, the episode of Dina getting kidnapped and abducted that comes right afterwards in the Parsha, Chazal say, was a punishment because you should not have hid Dina from Esav. Maybe she would have married him and turned Esav around. You know, a koach of a wife could be that powerful, that could be so powerful that he could even turn around the Russia like Esav. So Elamai, which one is it? Was he supposed to hired in the box to save class, or is it being criticized for it? So Victor Mill explained, no, it was the right thing. Maybe it was right for him to put Dean in the box, but he should have done it with a heavy heart. he should have at least felt, oy, isn't it a chaval that I can't give the opportunity, as much as I'd like to help my brother Esav transform himself into a tzaddik by marrying my daughter. There's got to be a feeling that, okay, there's a way I want to do it, there's a way I have to do it. I may not be able to do it in the optimal fashion. I may lose out, there may be a casualty, there may be collateral damage. Okay, but it's the right thing to do. But I got to feel as if there's something lost here. I got to feel as if there's a chisaron and a mission that's unfulfilled as a result. The duality, the dichotomy is possible and it's necessary. Also in this week's parsha, in the story of Sodom, right? So one thing that really emerges, and this is a highlight in the persona of Avraham Avinu, is that he goes to great lengths to daven on behalf of the people of Sodom. 50 tzaddikim, 45 tzaddikim, 40, right? He doesn't even know who these people are. He knows that they're Rishonim because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is ready to destroy them. And nevertheless, he's pouring out his heart, desperately trying anything he can to serve as that defense attorney on behalf of the people of Sodom, the Rishonim. So someone once asked I had the chutzpah to ask the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe was a great kanoi, and he was very, very vocal, especially against Zionists and anyone who was not on board with the program, so to speak. Eish lahava. So someone said to him, Rebbe, look at the way Avraham Avinu talks about the Rishon. Look how he davens to Hashem. Look how he davens to Hashem. Doesn't that indicate that maybe you should have a little more compassion for you? Hold it, man. They're not Rishon, they're from Jews. Okay, maybe they don't have the same attitudes about Medina Yisrael, but come on. Look how Avraham Avinu speaks about the Anshei Sodom. They were Rishon. And the rebel looked at him and he said, when you read the Parsha and you see that conversation, all you see is how Avraham Avinu speaks to Hashem. You don't see how Avraham Avinu would speak to the Rishon of his generation. Now, he would speak to Sodom. He would give them the same Moshe Shmuz and the same criticism. All you see is when he speaks to Hashem. And you've never seen me speak to Hashem about all those people. And then he broke down in tears. Right? He was trying to say, how can you judge what my Bein Adam L'Makom attitude is? I have this dichotomy inside my heart. To the people who are off the program, I need to say it like it is. I need to say the MS and not beat around the bush so people know what's right and what's wrong. But between me and the Rabbanu Shalom, of course I'm davening. I'm pouring out my heart for them, to see the light and for Hashem to have rachmanas on them. Ramanasha Klein, the Mishnah Halacha, writes like that in the Tshuva, that he says, they sometimes tell me to learn from the Rebbe to be Kanaim, but they don't learn from the Rebbeim to still have an inner respect for every Jew, because sometimes that's, that part is off the radar. It's not the glamorous part, and it's not the part that gets so much attention, but there's got to be a duality. There's so many different attitudes I can have at the same time, and they're all correct. They're all correct. There's a maisa with Rav Kook. This must go back to the 20s and 30s, and he was once walking with Rav Yaakov Moshe Harlap, who was one of his closest Talmidim, and the grandfather of our own Rabbi Chalap, the Rabbi Chalap who was the dean of our yeshiva for 39 years. He should be healthy and strong for many more years. Fortunately, he's not strong enough to come to yeshiva anymore. He's well into his 80s, maybe he's close to 90 already. So Rav Kook was walking with Rabbi Moshe Chalap through Yerushalayim, and they encountered the Beis HaGymnasia Herzliya. This is quoted in Rav Avner's Pirush Maseches Yesharim. And they got to a brand new building, which was a secular, anti-religious institution that was supposed to be the wave of the future for education for the children of Yerushalayim. And it was, the flagship of the secular movement at those times. And Rav Kook turned to Rav Chalap, and he said to me, when you get here, you have to make two brachas. One bracha is Baruch Matzah Gvul Amana. A new house is built in Eretz Yisrael, and you have to make a bracha on it. And at the same time, you have to make a second bracha. Baruch Sheyakar Avodah Zarah Me'aretzeinu. A bracha that you say when you see a church, when you see some sort of Avodah Zarah in Eretz Yisrael, there's also Avodah Zarah. Appella, how do you have to do it at the same time? How do you have both at the same time? So the answer is, Rav Kook said, you have to be broad-minded enough. We're not Malachi Asharis, right? But that's good. In some ways, that's good. To have multiple attitudes in the same circumstances is what Yiddishkeit demands of us sometimes. You see that in Parshas Vayigash, another few illustrations in Tanakh, in Perek Mem Hei, Pasuk Chav Hei, they get ready to go down to Mitzrayim, Yaakov and all his sons, after Yosef reveals himself, And Yaakov Avinu says at the end of the parak, Rav owed Yosef ben Yichai El Chaver Enem Terem Amos. He's so happy. Simcha v'cheder, Rashi says. He's celebrating. My son Yosef is still around. I gotta go see him before I die. Practically the next pasuk, he has a dream and Hashem says to him, Al tira merida Mitzrayim. He says, Yaakov, don't worry. I'm with you when you go down to Mitzrayim. Don't be afraid. I'm gonna take you out of there. You'll become a goy gadol while you're there. Zok Rashi, why do you have to tell him not to be afraid? He was afraid. He was pained that he had to leave Eretz Yisrael. What do you mean? A pasuk or two ago, you were celebrating, finally I get to see Yosef after 22 years before I die. And the next pasuk, Hashem says, don't worry, it's going to be okay, because he was afraid to leave. What do you mean he was afraid to leave Eretz Yisrael? Elamai, he was afraid to leave Eretz Yisrael. And at the same time that he was celebrating, at the same time that he was so happy about the fact that he was going to see Yosef. Both attitudes at the same time. It's not a contradiction. The beginning of Parshas Vayetze, Yaakov Avinu lies down and he goes to sleep and he wakes up in the morning. Takes the stone that was under his head, he pours the oil on top of it, he makes it into a matzeva to Kosh Baruch Hu, and he declares that, wow, this is the Makom HaMikdash, right? This is the Shar Shamayim Beis Elokim, and I didn't know. Rashi says, what do you mean you didn't know? What's he saying that for? What he means is, if I had known that this was the Beis Elokim, this was the Shar Shamayim, I never would have gone to sleep in the first place. What do you mean you never would have gone to sleep? You just had the greatest dream of all time. Hashem's going to protect you, and he's going to make you rich, and he's going to bring you back to your father's house, and you'll be a great nation. What do you mean? You saw the ladder with the malachim going up and down. You wouldn't have gone to sleep. You would have missed out on that dream and that privilege and that unbelievable nevuah. Zaki Bereskrov, yes, if there's a din that you don't sleep in the Makom HaMikdash, it doesn't matter what opportunities and what promises you're giving up, you don't sleep there. And he was able to feel that overjoyed response and with the Shemen al-Rosha on the Matzeva that he built and still say, you know what, if I could do it all over again, I wouldn't do it because it was the wrong thing to do. And it's not a contradiction. Once again, Yaakov Avinu demonstrates that for us. This is what the Mashgiach, Rav Nissim Bachvogel, Lakewood, used to say to his Talmidim, that the Yom Noraim, there's a simcha of the matzav of Chedvas Hashem Himu Uzcham on Rosh Hashanah, to feel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to forgive us and he's going to give us a new chance and be tachon that we're going to be zochah b'din. And at the same time, we have to have a pachad and a morah. And it says in the Torah that a person is supposed to get a haircut in Erev Rosh Hashanah with such confidence, but it also says in Rosh Hashanah, you shouldn't wear your fanciest clothing. And it's a machlokas. Should you fast on Rosh Hashanah or should you not fast on Rosh Hashanah? And we end up saying, well, it's okay to fast a little bit past Chatos, even if you're not going to fast the whole day. Right? There's a dual emotion that defines my Yom Noraim, and it's not Akasha. And a person needs to work on that, to be Margil himself, to have more than one attitude, to have pachad and to have simcha at the same time. The Rav used to say that this is so fundamental in our understanding of how we relate to the Churban. This is in Pirnei Arav, page Reish Chav Ches. The Rav said that the pasuk in Eicha, Zachri Yushalayim Yimei Anya Umudeha Kol Machmadeha, remember Yushalayim, the days of suffering and affliction, and all of its wonderful things. Right? Supposed to be reminiscent and nostalgic of Yerushalayim and also be mourning at the same time? The answer is yes. We have some mitzvahs that are zecher l'churban and we have some mitzvahs that are zecher l'mikdash. We have mitzvahs that give us an unfortunately, you know, somber note and a shtickle, we'll say, a sobering memory of Yerushalayim and the churban and the mourning involved. And at the same time, we will shake a lulav all 7 days, zecher l'mikdash, because we want to be back in the Beis HaMikdash doing that once again, 7 days of the whole sukkahs, midoraisa, not just the takana midorabanan in the cities outside of Yerushalayim. It's not akasha. The Malbim writes in the beginning of Parshas Yisro, Vayichad Yisro, he was happy. It's a lashon of Yichad. He was happy with. He says it means it was a happiness that comes from, that is able to be misgaber from the outside on an inner sadness, and that's his pshat. A friend of mine, Alex Leslie, once told me. He said that you can read that into Rashi. Rashi brings two pshatim. Vayichad means he was happy the Mitzrayim died and the Jews were saved, but he was also nice chidudim besar nice chidudim chidudim. His skin was crawling because he was so bothered by the loss of the Mitzrayim because he came from non-Jewish roots and the destruction of Mitzrayim. He once lived in Mitzrayim. He was the advisor of Paro, so it wasn't easy for him. But he was able to be Vayichad at the same time, be happy at the same moment. Maybe that's the pshat. The Gemara says that Yeshua was the first person to say Baruch Hashem, when he was the only person who, all those years, no one praised Hashem before, and of course not. Maybe he was the first person, he's a role model, he's a paradigm of someone who can praise HaKadosh Baruch and thank him, even when there was some internal struggle at the same time. Even when there's an internal struggle at the same time. L'chor Rabbo said, this is constant. All of our midos need to reflect it. The Kutzker Rebbe used to say, you need to have two pieces of paper in two pockets. One pocket has to have a paper that says, Anochi Ofer Ve'efer, I'm dust of the earth. And another piece of paper in your other pocket that says, V'tachzurei Ma'at Me'elokim, it's that man is just short of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Man can reach the 49th level of Bina, of Kedusha. We're almost there. We can have that greatness at the same time as we're Ofer Ve'efer, like Avraham Avinu says, we're the dust of the earth. It's not a stira. Miller said in a different context, you have to be able to harbor both feelings. Like we said, the churban and the simcha, the zechel and mikdash. If you think about it, right? You know, there was the happiest days of the year. Tu B'Av comes right after Tisha B'Av, or as I heard from Rabbi Eitan Feinman once, the happiest day of the year, Tu B'Av, when they celebrated in the midbar that they were no longer going to die from the meraglim, came still in the shloshim of the death of Aaron HaKohen, the same year, the final year in the Midbar. And they were able to celebrate the happiest day of the year 2 weeks after the greatest tragedy of Klal Yisrael, right? Rashi says that everyone mourned Aaron HaKohen, not just the, like we were discussing, Victor, at my apartment a few weeks ago, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was a mourning. Aaron HaKohen was a mourning. Then everybody participated, even the women participated. Everyone could feel that. Unbelievable. It's not a steer. You can feel both. Reb Leibach, the Rosh Yeshiva of Tells, after the war, it was Simchas Torah shortly after he heard that his entire family had perished during the war, in the Holocaust. And they asked him, how could you sing and dance on Simchas Torah? So he said, it's for real. Of course it's terrible, but we got to do it anyway. We got to do it. It's not a stira. Klal Yisrael can do it. We have the power to do it. We need to do it. It's part of the tchunas that we're capable of achieving. Even if it's more than one emotion at a time, that's what we're expecting. The Malachim can't do that. The Malachim, interestingly, is a Gemara in Brachos that says that how can HaKadosh Baruch Hu treat Klal Yisrael on the one hand, Asher lo yisafan v'yichach shochad, says that Hashem doesn't give any special treatment, doesn't take any bribes, but at the same time, Yis Hashem Panav Elecha, that same term of Yis Hashem Panav Elecha is the bracha that the Kohanim give to Klal Yisrael. So the Malachim can't see things from two different perspectives. Hashem responds to them, Chilo Esa Panav Yisrael, Kishakasatulam B'Torah V'chatul B'Savata V'Rachta Shemakecha. Klal Yisrael is extra medactic in brachos, in benching, and they deserve extra credit. They deserve a special treatment, but it's... But they couldn't. They only the Malachim could ask that question because they couldn't see those two attitudes at the same time. One last thing on a personal level, I very often feel this when talking to Rav Schechter in all of his godless. You know, there's an ava and there's a yira that sometimes a person can be struck with when they meet someone, when they develop a keshu with someone like Rav Schechter. And me'ain b'zeir anfin, it's something which is also supposed to help us replicate same type of emotion when it comes to our relationship with Hashem. When we speak to Rav Schechter for a few minutes, like I said the other day, you're blown away by his knowledge, by his Yirat Shamayim, by his Ahava for every member of Klal Yisrael, and it's humbling, and some people are scared from talking to him, which is silly because he's the sweetest, loving, most loving person in all of Klal Yisrael. And our base medrash exists because of him. And you're overcome with Yira. You just want to take a step back and say, wow, I'm so small. But then you overcome at the same time with an ava, with a desire. I want to come as close as I can to this person. I want to learn as much as I can from this person. I see how much he loves me. I want to come closer. And that's almost like what the Ram describes in Hilchos Yisodei Torah, how I'm supposed to see the world and the wonders of creation and just be like, jump back in being astounded. But at the same time, also be driven to say, oh, Kadosh Baruch Hu, I want to know everything about you and your world and what you want from me because it's so inspiring. That dichotomy, it's not a stira. There's an av and a yir that can coexist. So why am I making such a big deal about this particular inyan? So to quote something I saw in the name of Rabbi Dr. Twersky in his Haggadah last year, From Bondage to Freedom, he said the great mistake of modern psychology is that everything that you want to do in the field is about resolving conflicts. And he says that is very unfortunate, because adrabah, it makes us conflict averse. It makes us try to run away and stay away from what could actually make us better. There's something good about the tension. There's something we can grow from in that tension that will actually allow us to emerge better people through the struggle. And sometimes the struggle alone, beating back the Yetzer Hara every time that we feel it welling up inside of ourselves and making the right decision, even though we know, okay, there was another attitude that's also right over here, but I got to make the correct course of action for this particular moment, or I have to activate the correct hashkafa for this particular matzav. It's not a stira. It's not a stira. And we'll grow from that. I just, you know, to give one illustration of what I'm talking about, and then we'll bring it home. Rav Zevin reportedly, I'm not telling you to do this, you know, this is a great debate in Poskim, but Rav Zevin, the first time he saw the Kotel, he made a Shachriyano, and he also tore his Bugada. He recognized that this was an unbelievable moment of closeness to Hashem, because Baruch Hu Lozoz HaShechina from the Kosam HaRavi, but at the same time felt like I'm looking at a mosque on the Makom HaMikdash, and the base of Mikdash isn't here. But I'm not going to let the closest I feel with Hashem at this moment be overtaken by that sense of mourning. There's a balance I have to strike, but I will not let one overtake the other when both of them need to be felt. There's a pasuk in the beginning of Parshas Toldos. Rivka, you know, is suffering from difficult labor. She feels the rumbling inside of herself. Esav and Yaakov. One wants to run out, for Beis Avodah Zarah. The other one wants to run out at the Beis Medrash Me'aver, and she's told in the Beis Medrash, Shnei Goyim Bevitneich, Shnei Le'umim Me'aich Paredu, and now she's happy. And the question is, I don't understand. Why is she now put to rest from her struggle and her confusion by being told, oh, you're going to have two Goyim Bevitneich, two nations coming from inside of yourself. You're going to have a Yaakov, he's going to be the father of Klal Yisrael. But you know what else? You're going to have the worst rush of all time who will plague and torment your descendants until Mashiach comes. And we're still suffering from the Golos of Esav right now. You are going to have not just a Yaakov, but you're going to have one of the greatest Rishayim to ever live, and his descendants will be one of the among the greatest Rishayim to ever live. Right? So did that really put her at rest? Everyone always thinks, oh, you know, Rivka sort of comes to a little peace of mind after she's told that she has Shnei Goyim Bevinech. So what was the resolution over here? What was the satisfaction that she felt walking away? So there's a joke, but there's a lot of truth to it, and Rabbi Ruchem in the Sefer brings it not as a joke, but as an important lesson. The joke is that finally she was at peace, because up until now, she thought that she was going to have a YU guy. She thought that she was going to have a child who was just very confused, who was being pulled in many different directions. On the one hand, to the base of Avodah Zarah, on the other hand, to the base of Medrash, and he just doesn't know what to do, and sometimes he's here, sometimes he's there, and that would be the biggest disaster. And she was happy to hear that it's actually two different people, two different individuals with two different pulls, and each one will figure out the depth that they're supposed to take. Now, the joke is not a joke to bash YU. Chas v'shalom, we have a wonderful yeshiva, and the guys are putting in hard work to learn as much as possible and to invest, to make a kesher with their Bayim, and we're producing Bnei Torah and Talmid Chacham and Ovdei Hashem coming out of YU. But the joke has an important lesson. It's not the fault of YU, per se. It's the world we live in, right? There's so many responsibilities outside the base manager, parnasa and family. In a certain sense, you know, we call upon every guy. They have to, you know, make sure they're not leading a double life. But to have competing priorities and demands on their time, you know, and one, of course, is the base medrash, very strongly. Hopefully the other side of the coin isn't the base of Avodah Zarah of Esav, but you need to choose wisely. And sometimes the answer is the base medrash, sometimes the answer is not the base medrash. There's conflicts and there's challenges, and I need to learn Night Seder, and I need to learn after Night Seder, but there's also work I need to do. The things I need to for other people, for family members. And sometimes it's the choices about making the more significant sacrifices as you consider that eventually you're going to commit to find yourself as a Ben Torah. And there are lifestyle choices that I need to make, how I dress, how I spend my time, who my circle of friends are, how I eat, how I sleep, what I do during my vacation. And all these decisions can sometimes significantly impact on my desire to grow, but sometimes the other side of the coin, those things that I need to do and eat and places I need to be and people I need to associate with are necessary. And in any case, I may need to do this and I may need to do that and I have to make a choice. But emotionally, if I feel committed to Avodas Hashem and it demands X and priorities demand Y, regardless of the choice I make, I need to seek Eitzah to make the right decision. But just like Rav Schwab did and he learned from Yerucham, it doesn't mean that Torah or Midos or Akar Zatov is always going to be the approach that you take. Sometimes you have to say no to the Akar Zatov. Sometimes you have to say no to the extra night seder. But it doesn't dilute or compromise or weaken in any way my attachment to those Midos, attachment to the Yerushim, or the attachment to the Torah. The same Hargush is there. I need to be doing my homework right now, but I also need to be learning. I can't be. But I need to be learning. I want to be learning. But my Avodah Hashem demands of me to right now be doing my parnasa, to be learning accounting, whatever I need to be. But we can never just say it's all or nothing. We can never just say, okay, I'm learning now, so nothing else matters at it. But I certainly can't say I'm studying right now, and therefore I'm so disconnected from the learning that sometimes we lose our momentum, and it's hard to get back into it afterwards. But if I'm always feeling there's a hargasha where I want to be, we don't want to get down on ourselves. Sometimes that conflict can pull us down. You have to work against it and feel, no, I can harbor both attitudes. And we can condition ourselves, just like the Mashgiach was telling us, Yom Narayim, to achieve that. It's not always easy, but it is part of our ability to have both and not dilute the Ruchnius at all. Because at one point or another, one of the conflict factors are going to be absent, and I want my Ruchnius to kick back in full strength and full speed ahead as if nothing happened. As if it was never repressed. And Even when I'm considering, do I need to leave the basement right now? Even if the answer is yes, but if I've at least given the time and thought, do I really need to use it to leave the basement right now? Do I really need to use the time like that? Every once in a while, you may even realize that emphasis, you don't have to compromise. And you can learn a little bit more. Again, it's a struggle, and you need Eitzah, and it's not always easy. But the more that you're feeling both feelings, the more likely you'll make the right decision. Just reminds me of a story. With this, we'll close. When I was deciding what my future held, I wasn't sure if I wanted to be in chinuch or be an accountant. Almost switched the side sims, and I was very nervous. One thing that concerned me, that everyone should be concerned about, if you become a Baal Bus and you get a job in one of the many wonderful fields that are out there to earn a good, honest living, you want to make sure I don't slide into a numbness. I don't slide into a reality where, okay, now I'm not in yeshiva anymore, I'm not working on the same things, I'm not enthused by the same things, I'm not driven by the same things, so okay, I'll just sit in the back of the shul, I'll keep quiet, do my thing, daven 3 times a day, whatever, but I'm going to lose track of that constant growth and constant striving to be a bigger and bigger mentor that defines the years when a person's in yeshiva. And that can happen sometimes, because when you're not engaged actively and you're not making the effort to be engaged, then sometimes things get lost. And the spiritual desensitization can sometimes happen involuntarily. Rahman al-Islam. So what do I do to prevent it? Okay, so maybe I should go into chinuch. I don't think that's the best reason to go into chinuch just by default. But I was discussing this with Rabbi Cohn, and he said, in the name of David Lifshitz, whose picture is on the wall of our shiurim, to the right of the cell phone case, that Rav Lifshitz would often advise a person, dafka in that, who's troubled by that quandary, you should be an accountant. You know why? Because if you're standing at the top of a steep staircase, and if you don't hold on to the railing, you could trip and fall and break your leg, and instead you decide to just like jump on the banister and slide down, you're at risk to get hurt. But if you feel there's a pacha, you feel that there's a counterpoint that needs to be created, you feel that there's a little bit of a danger, if I don't take it slow, and I don't walk carefully, tread lightly and be careful, then you're at risk to lose it. Dafka, the person who stands at the top of the steps with a little trepidation and a little caution and a little anxiety, it's a healthy anxiety. It's a conflict of the internal struggle that if a person feels it, they have the chance to come out ahead when they're called upon to make the right decision. If you don't even feel that there's a conflict over here and you just sort of put the conflict out of the picture, that's what Dr. Tusk was saying. You don't build yourself. You're not stronger as a result. You haven't been proactive to make the right decisions to win and to be stronger. And you need to have that attitude. You really need to have that attitude. cognitive dissonance shouldn't water down my tshuka and yearning to come close to Hashem, to learn, to be believable with Darkei Hashem, but to accept that my avodas Hashem is sometimes to feel both hargashas. Not to regret the time that I have to sacrifice, if that's what the situation demands, but to, you know, to make sure that this is really who I am at all times, even when I can't be proactive about it, but to feel that I'm still moving on the same trajectory, and when I'm able to get back on that same boat, I won't lose my step, I won't lose my momentum, and I'll always have a powerful feeling of where I want to be and when I can be there. B'siyata d'shmaya.